From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said in a statement today that he knows the situation at the southern border is difficult and he's working around the clock to manage it. But new government data show that as of Sunday, there were more than 4,200 migrant children in custody, each spending an average of 117 hours in detention at the border. That goes way beyond the 72-hour legal limit. Lawyers who interviewed some of these children say they are being held in crowded tents while they wait to be transferred to shelters or sponsors. And they say the kids only get about 20 minutes every few days outside. They haven't showered in days. Let's bring in an attorney who's paying close attention. Efren Oliveras is Deputy Legal Director for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Immigrant Justice Project, and he's based in McAllen, Texas. Welcome back. Good to talk with you.
Good morning. My pleasure.
And I should say, you have not recently been to these overcrowded detention centers, but you have worked with unaccompanied children in the past. How do the conditions that I just described compare to what you've seen before?
Well, you know, it's a shame that we're going back to that situation with the new administration. Instead of fully reimagining our approach to our immigration system, in particular with respect to children, simply going back to the pre-Trump paradigm of detaining children is a seriously missed opportunity.
All right, well, let's get into some of why this is happening. Republican members of Congress were at the border yesterday blaming the surge on the new administration. Here's House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy in El Paso.
The sad part about all of this, it didn't have to happen. This crisis is created by the presidential policies of this new administration. There's no other way to claim it than a Biden border crisis.
So clearly, this is becoming politicized, but I need you to put this into some context for us. It's happened before, as you mentioned, 2019 and 2014. What's going on this time?
You know, there have been previous increases in the number of children arriving at our border. But this time, I think it's important to keep in mind that what's behind this is what the Trump administration was doing in terms of expelling children using COVID as an excuse. The Biden administration is no longer expelling unaccompanied minors. And that is part of the reason why now we have an increased number of children in the United States. The representatives who are now voicing their views about this quote-unquote crisis, I didn't hear them complaining about the way children were being treated in the last 4 years. So it unfortunately, the politics often get in the way of a true respect for the human rights of immigrant children.
Under normal circumstances, these kids are supposed to be moving through Border Patrol custody and into shelters or to sponsors within 72 hours. We now know that it's taking 117 hours on average. So why can't the administration comply with that law?
One of the reasons is that the number of facilities available for that is less than it was prior because the Trump administration shut down some of those facilities. So now there are fewer places in which to process the children more quickly. But more importantly is that we're going back to this law enforcement-minded approach to processing immigrant children when this is not primarily a law enforcement issue. It's primarily a humanitarian issue. And if we're going to be true to our commitment to treating children, regardless of the color of their skin, regardless of the language they speak or where they were born, with the humanity that all children deserve, then we need to approach this situation completely different, not from a law enforcement mindset, but from a children welfare mindset involving child welfare experts, involving trauma-informed counselors, social workers. That's what needs to happen. That's where the resources need to be shifted towards that child-centered approach and not a law enforcement-centered approach.
Okay, I do hear you. On the other hand, the reality is this is a huge political challenge, as we've already discussed. It is a huge logistical challenge because there just aren't the places to put these children. And the pandemic, by the way, is making it even harder to do that now because of capacity issues. But if those things were not complicating matters, how would you solve this problem? What does the solution look like in a perfect world?
Well, again, taking the approach that is 100% focused on the well-being of the children. And there's laws in every state in the United States that center the best interest of the child when it comes to custody determinations, when it comes to what facility they should be at. the guiding principle is always the best interest of the child. If we apply that principle to this context, things would be, look very differently. And, you know, on the one hand, I understand that there are logistical challenges, that there's fewer facilities and there's pressure on the administration. At the same time, a couple of weeks ago, we landed a rocket on Mars, or a rover on Mars. So to say that it's too difficult for the federal government to manage is disingenuous. I also am aware of the political difficulties because the border and anti-immigrant issues are a lightning rod for the right wing in this country. So I understand the political difficulties, but from my perspective and the perspective of most immigrant advocates, it is to keep respecting the human rights of everyone arriving at the border, especially children.
Efren Olivares is Deputy Legal Director for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Immigrant Justice Project. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are on the campaign trail again this week. They're campaigning for the administration's massive COVID-19 rescue plan Biden signed last week. It was approved by Congress without Republican support. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He joins us now. And Julian, I think it can be hard for a lot of us to realize the magnitude of a measure like this as it's happening. Start with the sheer scale of this COVID relief package. How does it compare, for instance, with FDR's New Deal?
Well, it's a huge bill, which will have major effects on our immediate crisis with the pandemic. And it has provisions such as the expansion of the child credit, strengthening of the ACA, that will have long-term ramifications. It's not quite a New Deal, though. The New Deal was a huge array of programs from the Tennessee Valley Authority to banking insurance to Social Security that remade the social contract on a permanent basis. And so while this is large, it's very significant, it's too early to see this as being comparable to a period where the federal government was essentially remade.
Although I wonder if it's attempting to be a new deal. Could the COVID rescue plan is really a response to a public health crisis, which has had a staggering economic cost. In that respect, is the situation similar to what Roosevelt faced during the Great Depression? Does Biden's plan really address how severely people are hurting today?
Well, it is comparable, and I do think the Great Depression is a model, a comparison point for the kind of crisis that we face today that has just rippled throughout every part of American society. I do think the bill is responsive to that crisis. It does things like provide states and localities with more money. It helps with the vaccine rollout. It will help schools reopen, which are all essential pillars of what we need to rebuild. But it has to go hand in hand with the public health program and the actual implementation of the vaccine rollout, because ultimately we're not looking for an economic stimulus. We're looking for normalcy again. And so I think it's going to be a set of policies that hopefully get us back there.
And what about the way Biden, as we said, is campaigning for this? He's on this Help Is Here tour. Compare that to FDR's campaign, his selling of the New Deal and his famous fireside chats on the radio. And let's listen to one of them. Here he is in the first fireside chat. It happened March 12th of 1933. There'd been a run on the banks because the economy had collapsed and people were trying to pull all their cash out.
I want to tell you what has been done in the last few days and why it was done, and what the next steps are going to be.
Now, FDR faced opposition from some Republicans, and Biden didn't get any support for his COVID relief plan. How do the politics compare then to now, and how does public opinion compare?
Well, I think the politics of what Biden is doing is a little bit like FDR. He's trying to sell the program. He's trying to remind voters what he just did. He's responding to the fact many people thought President Obama didn't do enough of that back in 2009 with his stimulus program and ultimately hurt himself politically. Unlike FDR, though, President Biden faces a Republican Party where there'll be zero potential for compromise. On the other hand, he faces a party that's much more united internally than Democrats were back in the 30s when there was a division between Southerners and Northerners. So if Biden's willing to be partisan, if he's willing to focus on keeping his party together, I think he has a lot of opportunities ahead of him.
And you say Democrats were right to go big on this these days, on Biden's plan. Why?
Look, voters like leaders who lead, and the way presidents do that is to pass big programs. And Americans also like public policies. They often rail against government, but they love their Social Security. They love their Medicare. And to get big programs, you have to be willing to take risks. And if this program that just passed works, and if it gets us back to a more normal place in a few months, I think voters are going to be quite pleased with the Biden administration.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Nice to talk to you as always, Julian. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
It is dangerous to be a journalist in many parts of the world. The International Federation of Journalists has a new report that says 65 people who work in media were killed in 2020. The global death toll is 17 more than the year before, and each of them died doing their jobs. Ernest Sagaga is with the International Federation of Journalists. He's on Skype from Brussels. And Ernest, these numbers really do hit close to home for us, but why do you think so many more journalists are dying?
There are many reasons, but I think the main one is that killing a journalist has become a risk-free endeavor. That's the main reason driving violence in journalism. There are many reasons, of course, other reasons such as armed conflicts. And as you know, journalism is all about proximity with to the action. And naturally, some of our colleagues actually do lose their lives in crossfire incidents. By and large, many journalists are killed in their own communities, in their own cities, in their own countries, simply for exposing corruption, exposing abuse of power, and exposing crime.
It may surprise some people that Mexico had the highest number of journalist deaths in 2020. It was 14, according to your report. What can you tell us about Mexico? What were those reporters working on that led to their deaths?
To be honest, I would be surprised if anybody is surprised about what is going on in Mexico, because Mexico has been topping our lists for 4 out of the last 5 years now. And the main driving reason is actually organized crime. We have crime barons who use a reign of terror to suppress any journalist or indeed anyone who would like to expose what they do. And they have been doing it for many years and I'm afraid getting away with it. So it is no surprise to us. But it is indeed very troubling.
And speaking of impunity, you're saying that very few people, if anyone, has been arrested or held responsible for those deaths.
Indeed. That's we have, according to our findings, and we do it every single year, only one case out of 10 is prosecuted. That's basically an open season on journalists in many parts of the world, especially in less democratic regimes or indeed in very fragile states where the central governments have no control or very little control on the entirety of their territory.
We spoke recently with the BBC's Lise Doucette in Kabul, and she was telling us about the number of journalists being killed recently in Afghanistan. And in fact, 3 women were murdered earlier this month. They worked at a local TV station. Are you noticing more violence against female journalists?
Yes, we are, especially in Afghanistan. Thank you for raising that case, because we saw a spate of killings targeting journalists toward the end of last year. There are really people in Afghanistan who want to scare people, who want to scare the media. And as you know, speaking of failing states and fragile states, Afghanistan is one of them. And one sector which was trying to contribute to the rebuilding of the country was the media sector. And it is being really targeted to prevent it from making its contribution, especially targeting women journalists.
I spoke last week with a journalist named Andrea Sahori. She's a reporter here in the U.S. for the Des Moines Register. She was arrested during the Black Lives Matter protest last year. I want to play a little tape from our interview. Here it is.
I put my hands up and I said, I'm press. And he immediately grabbed me, pepper sprayed me right in the face at close range and said, that's not what I asked.
So Andrea was found not guilty last week, and it's just one case. But your report says that journalists around the world are not only being murdered for doing their job, but they are being jailed, just like Andrea, for doing their jobs. Why is that?
Yes, actually, that again, very relevant to our discussion, the clip you just played. And we are seeing many journalists being detained, being jailed, simply because they try to report on public events. Like you say, in America, somebody who goes to report on a public protest, we are seeing the same thing in Belarus. Everybody knows that when they take somebody to court, especially in a democracy, a country which where the rule of law exists, our colleagues will come out free. They know that. But they're simply doing it to intimidate our colleagues and prevent them from reporting what they see.
Well, you're right, Ernest. Anyone who appreciates and values democracy, this is a concerning conversation, talking about jailing or murdering journalists. The goal in many of these circumstances is to silence those reporters, to make sure that their work is not heard. But is it effective? I mean, are the journalists still going out there and doing their jobs and reporting that information, despite the threats?
Yes, indeed they are. And that's a very good thing to see and to talk about, because they are able to do so because the public, people are turning to their traditional media for the accurate information. So that is an encouragement to our colleagues all over the world to keep going despite these very real threats and danger to their lives.
Ernest Sagaga is head of human rights and safety at the International Federation of Journalists. We'll link you to the group's report that says 65 journalists were killed around the world last year. Ernest, thank you for the work you do. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Hospitals and mental health facilities across the country cannot accommodate the growing number of people who need urgent psychological help. They've relegated patients to waiting rooms and even hallways, sometimes for days before they admit them to a psychiatric unit. There are lots of reasons patients are kept waiting. Historically, insurance companies pay less for psychiatric care in this country, and it's hard for people just to get coverage. Last January, an 8-year-old boy was rushed to the emergency department at Boston Children's Hospital. He was in the midst of a mental health crisis. Karen Broadhurst adopted the child a few years ago. She'd been his foster mom and knew he'd been abused and neglected when he was younger. Because of the trauma, he acted out aggressively. He did that night in January. We spoke to Broadhurst a few weeks later, and we'll update you on the story in a few minutes. But first, here's what happened to force Broadhurst to call 911 on her child.
He was on top of my bed, and he picked up my med organizer, and he threw it as hard as he could onto the floor. And he began to try to grab the medications and threatened to swallow them. And I had to physically hold on to him until the police arrived.
He was 8 years old then. What would compel him to swallow the medications or try to?
I think because of his trauma history, he goes into a fight or flight mode. And he is feeling out of control. I don't know how else to explain it. I don't think that he had any intention to kill himself. I think he just was trying to do something that he knew would be really bad and upsetting.
When they got to Children's Hospital, doctors wanted to admit the child. That's when the mother and son's latest odyssey began. If Broadhurst's son had broken his leg or had a bad case of pneumonia, the hospital likely could have admitted him right away. But he needed a bed on a behavioral health floor, and there were none available anywhere in the state. So the little boy languished. He spent 5 nights stuck in the emergency department. Finally, the hospital moved him to a regular medical floor at Children's.
If he were inpatient, he would be in a unit with other kids similar in age. The psychiatrist who sees him would be making changes to his medication if warranted. Basically, he's just sitting in a room playing with Legos all day and watching TV and playing video games.
Karen Broadhurst and her little boy are used to having to spend weeks in a hospital waiting for a bed in a psychiatric unit. The problem is known as boarding. Dr. Patricia Ebeziako is associate clinical chief in the psychiatry department at Boston Children's Hospital.
What we really want to see is for children to be able to get the right care in the right setting at the right time. And boarding is not a reflection of people being in the right setting for the right care that they need. And boarding affects children and adolescents with psychiatric illness significantly more than those with medical illness. And the problem has been worsened significantly during the pandemic.
According to the state's Executive Office of Health and Human Services, boarding for psychiatric beds among children and adults has increased as much as 400% per month since June over the previous year. After a patient has been boarding for 60 hours, the case is escalated to the State Department of Mental Health, which has to try to locate a bed. The state says for pediatric patients, it takes an average of 4 days to find one. Broadhurst's son has been waiting 4 weeks longer than that. They celebrated his 9th birthday in the hospital.
It was great. The child life specialists really helped. They brought in a cake. They brought in some clowns on an iPad. There was singing.
Happy birthday to you. Let's cut the cake.
My son really enjoyed cutting up the cake and scooping ice cream for everyone.
All right, we'll leave you to it. Here's a little love from the Laugh League, okay?
Okay.
There you go, my friend. Enjoy the cake.
Thanks.
So he was helping people to some cake and ice cream. He is a really sweet kid, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's a very sweet and thoughtful and funny and kind. Yeah, and smart.
What or who is at fault here?
I wish it was as simple as that. I think our representatives in state government need to prioritize our children's mental health and understand that this is a crisis, and they can find a way in an emergency to make extra beds for COVID, and they should be able to find a way in an emergency to find extra psych beds for our children who are in crisis. I do understand that the state has some plans over the next couple of years, but that's not going to solve the problem today. And we can't wait 6 months or a year. They need to find a solution right now.
We have this update on our story. Karen Broadhurst's now 9-year-old son finally was sent to a psychiatric unit on his 36th day in the hospital. Doctors we've spoken with say the problem of a lack of psychiatric beds is a disgrace that's gone on for decades, but put into even starker relief by the pandemic.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just help you keep up with the news, we help you make sense of what's happening. Like what the case about George Floyd's killing means for the ongoing fight for racial justice, or how to best navigate a pandemic that's changed life for all of us. All of that in 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
The Prime Minister of Thailand got a shot of the AstraZeneca vaccine today. It was a big moment in a country that had temporarily suspended the vaccine over concerns that it caused blood clots in a small number of people. Thailand changed course after health experts said it was safe, but other countries aren't convinced yet. Sweden and Germany are the latest to stop using it for now. Let's hear from Jennifer Nuzzo. She's an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks so much.
So far, there are about 36 reports of people getting blood clots up to a week after receiving that AstraZeneca vaccine. But the World Health Organization is among the groups saying, look, there is no proven link here. So what do you think? Are these countries being too cautious?
Yeah, it does feel that way. I mean, of course, countries have to review all safety data. And if reports emerge that are concerning, I think, you know, potentially a suspension or pause is warranted. However, that always has to be balanced against the risk of not continuing to give vaccinations. And many of the countries that we're hearing about pausing are very much in the grips of what is a deadly infection. So we have to, you know, be concerned that what we are essentially doing is risking people continuing to get infected from something that we know very much is bad for them.
Oh, well, the other thing is that AstraZeneca is expected to submit its vaccine to the FDA for approval late this month or in early April in this country, and the U.S. has committed to buying it once it's been approved. So if more countries around the world appear to be hesitant, do you think that would damage its reputation here before it's even authorized?
It is possible. I mean, we've already seen challenges in rolling out multiple vaccines that all are very protective, but because they are, conduct several different clinical trials, the data that comes out of them, while they can't be directly compared, people inherently do that. And we have a perception that some vaccines are better than others. That doesn't track with reality. The reality is all of the vaccines that are in use are quite good at protecting people against illness, which is exactly what we want them to do. So yes, I think anytime that there are these high-level news reports, we have to worry about people getting the wrong impression about these vaccines and worrying that they may be harmful when in fact they're not taking into account the very known harms of this deadly virus.
Yeah, and just to be clear here, is there anything in the data that you've seen that are cause for concern?
No, not so far. I mean, we haven't actually seen much data on the blood clots other than the numbers reported. And I think one of the things that they'll be doing is, of course, looking at the individuals in whom the clots occurred, seeing if there are any clinical reasons for that, but also comparing it to the statistical likelihood that blood clots would occur just because they occur in people. And one of the things they'll do is to see, you know, the frequency that these have been observed and if that's an unusual number compared to the frequency we would expect in these individuals otherwise had they not received the vaccine. European Medicines Agency, which, like our FDA, has voted confidence, and I think that's an important signal.
Well, let's take a minute to talk about the so-called UK variant of this disease. We know that it is transmitted more easily, but now there's a new study in the journal Nature out yesterday that finds the UK variant is also more deadly than other variants. What should we know about that?
Yeah, this new study confirms what other studies have shown, particularly another study by another group that was published in a different journal a few weeks ago. And essentially what we now see is that individuals who are infected with this may have about, you know, somewhere between 50 to 60% greater likelihood of severe outcomes. So quite a worrisome thing, but we have to continue to take precautions.
Yeah. Johns Hopkins University epidemiologist Jennifer Nuzzo, thank you.
Thanks so much.
During this past year of pandemic and racial reckoning, maybe you felt so moved by an experience or so outraged that you wanted to write something about it. Maybe in a post or a letter to an op-ed page. If you've wondered how to begin to say what you want to say, Trish Hall has some suggestions. She's the author of the book Writing to Persuade. When Hall was editor of the New York Times op-ed page, the staff got 800 to 1,000 submissions every week from heads of state to ordinary people with an opinion. And she's made writing that starts off meh really shine. Trish Hall told us in a July 2019 interview what made her want to write the book.
Well, you know, I started out incredibly sort of sincere and earnest, and I'm going to read every single thing that comes in. And you realize after a while that if the first paragraph isn't really good, I mean, indeed, sometimes if the subject line isn't really good, you just aren't going to keep going. It's possible that buried in that piece would be something valuable, but no one's ever going to get there. So I think it was day after day of seeing how really smart, really interesting people undercut themselves.
Some of the mistakes people make, the most common, say four of them that you've seen as an editor, they try to cover too much ground, they write in generalities, write complicated sentences that need to be pruned, or they use so much jargon that what they're saying is unintelligible to anybody outside their field. Another thing you say is that it was people who were well-known in some cases, very influential, sometimes writers, who made these very mistakes.
Yeah, I think that just because you're good at writing a novel doesn't mean that you can write a really effective 750-word op-ed. And just because you're a brilliant speaker, it's the same problem. I think there are a lot of really brilliant people in academia who are so used to the language of their field that when they try to reach out, they have trouble speaking in everyday conversational English.
And do you edit them?
Oh, yeah, we edited them, and a lot of people were fine about it. Some people hated it, and they would just walk away. But, you know, op-ed was an interesting balance because when you're an editor in the newsroom, you're in partnership with the reporter, but really the editor has the final say. When you're doing op-eds, it's the work of an outside contributor. So we would check the facts. If we had disputes over the facts, of course, they had to be right. But it's their piece. And so if we edited the piece in such a way that they didn't feel like it was them anymore, they would just withdraw it. And that was certainly their right.
And then you'd wait and see if it showed up in another big name newspaper.
That happened most often with celebrities who really didn't want to be edited at all. And, you know, it's totally understandable because they can go anywhere. They have millions of Twitter followers. They're on Instagram. They don't need a place like the New York Times the way they might have once needed it.
But you still get lots of offers from celebrities who want their words to appear on the op-ed page of the New York Times. You specifically write about Bono, the rock singer and humanitarian. Would you tell us the story about when you got a submission from him?
He had contributed a series of pieces to op-ed before I was there. And I think people, you know, thought he was good. But I think that was the one that suffered from just being too general. Like, maybe it was poverty in Africa, and we have to spend billions, we have to fix it. I mean, everybody kind of knows that there are certain big problems in the world. And if you go at them in a very general, comprehensive way, you're usually not saying anything new.
So you ended up rejecting that op-ed piece. But then you got, I think it was a week later, another submission from Bono, who was writing with Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. And right. You took a different approach to that. How come?
I don't know that it was a different approach, but it was a different result. It was the same kind of problem, or it was too general. And I asked if they could be more specific and dig into a certain aspect of it. And they did. And I thought it was much better and runnable. I mean, you always have this funny balance in journalism where you want, you know that people want to hear from famous people. So you want them, but you don't want them if they're not going to be saying something that feels newsworthy.
I think a good example of that was when Angelina Jolie, the actress, wrote about her decision to have a double mastectomy because her BRCA testing, the genetic testing, showed that she was predisposed to breast cancer and ovarian cancer. But a key ingredient in this, you write, was that Jolie was willing to go personal.
She could have just written a piece about the BRCA gene and how it, you know, is it something everyone should be tested for? It could have read like a public service announcement, which is fine. But she really exposed herself. I mean, she's a very glamorous actress writing about having her, you know, surgery. And I think that because it was so personal, a lot of women could identify with it. And I think by doing that, she did a lot of good.
A lot of people listening to this might think, gee, I would love to have an op-ed in the New York Times or even my local newspaper, but they're not sure where to begin, not sure how to formulate an opinion on the page or even in speech for that matter. What do you say to them?
I think that they should always start with what their experience is and what they know. If it's somebody who has strong feelings about how you can reach peace in the Middle East, unless they're somehow a diplomat or involved in the peace process, the odds of that being published are pretty slight. What people need to do is look at what they have to say, what they've experienced, what they've learned. You know, maybe they hike a lot in the woods near their house and they see certain changes in the ecosystem of the woods, and that brings up some larger issue about the environment. Like, I'm not saying they just write about their walk in the woods, but they need to start with what they know. And I think the great thing about media now is there's so many places that will take opinion pieces. There's so many great digital places to go that if people have ideas, it's a great time to try getting them out there.
A lot of venues, but not a lot of editing. And I think that often there are many words that don't add up to much. I think you probably have seen that as well. And I wonder what writers can do about that.
Sadly, I think that people have to learn to edit themselves. I mean, they might be lucky and get a good editor, but I think they have to be pretty rigorous with their own words. They can show the piece to a friend. They can wait a day and read it aloud to themselves. And they just need to go over it and eliminate extraneous words and really try to be their own editors, because they won't always get good editors.
And it's not just about opinion, even though it's an opinion piece. You have a chapter, When Facts Matter, Even Though They Don't. How do you use facts in a persuasive and relevant way?
every opinion piece has facts, and at the Times we would always check the facts and make sure they were right. But there's a lot of false information out there, and they've done studies that show that false information travels more quickly around the web than accurate information. So it's pretty discouraging, but you need to have your own facts be right, partly because if you're really trying to be persuasive and some people in your audience notice that you get something wrong, they'll discount what you have to say. So it's a very odd mix where it's often emotion and storytelling that are more convincing to people than facts, or people just, they choose to believe the facts that match their own opinions.
So what do you do about that? Because a lot of people also don't want to be persuaded. You know, they don't want to be thinking that they'd been wrong all this time about something. How do you address that?
I think that you can only start changing people's minds by sort of listening to how they feel and understanding what their value system is and thinking about, given their value system, what might make them look at a certain issue differently. One of the people I really admired was the person who actually gave me the idea to write this book is Arthur Brooks. Now, he was the head of the American Enterprise Institute, which was a conservative think tank. One piece in particular I remember where he was writing about how few social scientists at universities are conservative, and he was basically making the case that they're discriminated against. But he did it in such a way that he played into the sort of classic liberal value of fairness, and liberals tend to be against discrimination. So I felt like he was very good at thinking about what his audience would find disturbing and then sort of turning it around and saying, well, do you think it's okay to discriminate against conservatives? And so I think that is a very important way to reach people to understand what their values are.
Former New York Times op-ed page editor Trish Hall's book is Writing to Persuade, How to Bring People Over to Your Side.
Governments around the world are struggling to get vaccines out to the most vulnerable populations. But 1 year ago, in March 2020, another shortage cut the knees out from under the fight against COVID-19 in the United States. From the beginning, the U.S. simply did not have enough tests, despite then-President Trump's repeated claims to the contrary. Here he is in March 2020.
Anybody that needs a test gets a test. They're there. They have the tests. And the tests are beautiful. Anybody that needs a test gets a test.
But the truth was, tests were not widely available to most people for months. Derek Thompson is staff writer at The Atlantic, and he joins us now. He's been thinking about this. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So even though most of us are now focusing on access to vaccines, I do think it's instructive to go back in hindsight and look at testing, because last March, the WHO had just declared the outbreak a pandemic. It had even offered to send diagnostic tests to the U.S. Why didn't the government accept them?
You could argue that it starts with a little bit of hubris. We were the United States of America. We thought that we had the best public health system in the world, and we could design our own effective tests. So we never requested to get the WHO's tests. Instead, we designed our own tests. And those tests came out of the box as a failure. The CDC's original test kits were declared failures, possibly due to a lab contamination. And so it took many, many weeks in order for the CDC to actually send out approved tests that really worked. At the same time that the CDC was failing, another regulatory agency, the FDA, was also dragging its feet on approval. There were scientists around the country, including at the University of Washington, that was screaming at Washington, D.C., and saying, we've got a test that works. Please authorize it so that we can start shipping this thing and having it mass manufactured. And it didn't happen for weeks and weeks and weeks. So by the time America's testing capacity got to the point where it could be even marginally useful for testing people who had the most severe illnesses, this disease had already spread invisibly throughout the country. And my case in this article is that by the time we started testing accurately, so many of the 500,000 plus deaths that happened in this country were already effectively baked in because of the exponential spread that we couldn't see for weeks and weeks in the early stage of this crisis.
There were so many other problems in the early response to this pandemic. Inconsistent public health messaging, for one, no guidance on wearing masks, a shortage of masks, shortage of gloves and gowns, that sort of thing. Do you think the problems with the testing was the biggest problem of all?
I call our test failure the original sin of America's COVID-19 response. It was the original sin that infected every other daily tragedy. So let's talk about two of the things that you mentioned, masks and broader economic shutdowns. Well, you start with masks. With more tests, we would have learned more faster about this disease. We would have learned, for example, that it was clearly spreading through asymptomatic infection and super spreaders. And that would have strongly suggested an airborne virus that spreads not by touch through our hands, but through our noses and mouth. So you would have had Dr. Anthony Fauci saying, not in March that he was wavering on everyday mask use, but rather coming out enthusiastically to encourage every American to wear a mask earlier. Second, you look at something like the shutdowns. The shutdowns were broadly necessary in a lot of states and a lot of cities when we had no idea who was sick. An invisible virus that escaped detection was spreading through our cities and through the country. But the point of a test is to make the invisible visible. If you know who is sick and who isn't, you don't have to shut down as many schools, shut down as many weddings or funerals. You don't have to entirely close the leisure and hospitality economy, as we effectively had to do in this country last spring. If you can see the otherwise invisible virus, you can take different measures to reduce its spread while keeping things otherwise as normal as possible.
Well, and maybe, Derek, we could have also tracked new variants before they became widespread.
That's a really, really good point. I think that, you know, it's not just that testing tells us who is sick and who isn't. Testing tells us more about the nature of this virus. It improves our epidemiological knowledge about what's going on. It could lead to genomic testing that could tell us about certain variants, if the disease is behaving differently this month than it was last month. But you don't have the same option to do this kind of test, this genomic testing, to do this kind of sequencing, if you can't see the problem in the first place. And that's what testing can do, and what we didn't do in 2020, which is see this viral spread for what it was in the early weeks and months.
And just briefly, what do you think we should learn from this testing failure going forward?
Well, the COVID-19 pandemic, I think and hope, is in its final stage in the U.S., but this is not going to be the last pandemic of the 21st century, and that's because it's not even the first pandemic of the 21st century. That would have been the H1N1 influenza in 2009. So in 21 years, we've already had two pandemics. And let's say we have another pandemic every single decade going forward. We need a plan going forward so that we don't have to shut down our economy once every 9 or 10 years. The best way to do that is to open up testing and to plan mass testing before the next crisis hits.
Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.